Reading this morning is from Romans chapter 2, verses 17 through 24. Indeed, you are called a Jew, and the rest on the law, and make your boast in God, and know his will, and approve the things that are excellent, being instructed out of the law, and confident that you yourself are a guide to the blind, a light for those who are in darkness, an instructor of the foolish teacher of babes, having the form of knowledge and truth in the law. You therefore who teach another, do you not teach yourself? You who preach that a man should not steal, do you steal? You who say, do not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who harbor idols, do not rob temples. You who make your boast in the law, do not dishonor God through breaking the law. For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you, as it is written.
Thank you, Steve. Before we get into our lesson this morning, just a couple of details I want to pass along to everyone. I failed to put in the bulletin that tomorrow Larry and Susan are going to be leaving for 2 or 3 weeks. They're going on a trip to New Zealand and Australia. So we need to think of them while they're separated from us on their trip and look forward to what they have to report about their trip when they get back. Also, just a little bit of advance notice. Today we're finishing up a series on answering critics, but next Sunday I'm going to begin a new series of lessons based on the Old Testament book of Malachi. It's a short little book at the very end of the Old Testament, but it's packed with a lot of very relevant information and injunctions for God's people yet today. And so I thought it would be worth our while to spend several weeks in plowing through the little book of Malachi. And I would encourage you between now and next Sunday to get your Bibles down and read Malachi chapters 1 through 4 and get a little familiar with the text, and it might help you get more out of that series of lessons that begins next week. Today we are wrapping up a series that we have been in pretty much from the first of the year on the subject of answering critics. Today, perhaps more than ever, those who embrace the religion of Christ are subjected to a great deal of criticism and complaints about our religion and the various elements of our religion. And in this series, we have been trying to go through and look at some of the major complaints, criticisms that people have about Christianity in an effort to try to provide some kind of a response. Not necessarily that this audience needs that information as much as our children need it, because certainly they are being overwhelmed in the culture that they live in by a lot of negative press regarding Christianity. But we need to prepare ourselves to be able to answer these criticisms that our friends or co-workers may level against us and what we believe. We've looked at a number of different topics. I'm not going to mention all of them that we have gone through. Last week we were looking at the story of Jesus and why Jesus is unlike any other human being that's ever lived and is worthy of our admiration and respect and honor and worship. And today we're going to be looking then at the movement that grew out of the life and the teachings of Jesus that we historically have called Christianity. And Christianity has come under attack, under fierce attack in recent years. And the criticism goes something like this: all religion, but especially Christianity, is responsible for much of the hatred and the violence and the injustice that we see in the world around us. And that if religion in general and Christianity in particular did not exist, if it could just be eliminated overnight, then so much of the problems that this world is wrestling with right now would just disappear. We wouldn't have these problems anymore. And so Christianity has become the scapegoat for a great deal that mankind recognizes is twisted and broken about the world that we live in. And the sad thing is, there's an awful lot of evidence to back up that criticism. You look back over the last 2,000 years of history, and what do we see? The story of the Crusades and all the atrocities that were committed under the banner of Christ. Think of the Inquisition in Spain, in which people who didn't believe the right way were tortured and in many cases executed. Consider the religious wars that racked the continent of Europe during the 15 and 1600s as Protestants and Catholics were slugging it out as to who was going to dominate their respective nations. Think of the Salem witch trials, the civil wars that racked places like Northern Ireland in more recent times. And the list could go on and on of all of the violence that has been committed in the name of Christ. But think also of some of the horrible mistreatment of fellow human beings that Christians, in many cases, were guilty of committing. The African slave trade is something that, like it or not, was at least at one point in time endorsed or practiced by those who called themselves Christians. And there are stories of those in the antebellum South who would go to a church service such as like as we are doing right here this morning, and they would sing praises to God and read from their Bibles, pat each other on the back about what good, fine Christians they were, and then go home and beat their slaves. This is Christianity? Is this what you defend as a follower of Christ? And even today, think of the bigotry. Think of the radicalism that is peddled in the name of Christ. I'm thinking specifically in our own state, the Westboro Baptist approach to dealing with sin and wickedness. There's no doubt that the devil is having his way in our country today, but is this the way that we deal with it? Is this the way that we correct the problem that we face, the sin that surrounds us in our culture? In all of this, and so many other examples that we could trot out, and that atheists are more than happy to give us, we have to say, guilty as charged. Christianity, frankly, just has a lousy track record when it comes to living the Spirit of Christ in a world of sin and sorrow. In fact, in many cases, you could almost say it's an embarrassment. And that's why a lot of people today who are Christians, they claim to be Christians, but they keep it quiet. Because it's just much easier, it's much safer not to let other people know that I am a committed Christian because they're going to try to hang all of this sort of junk on me. And it's easier just to kind of pretend that I'm not with that group of people. We're reminded of this every time we hear of another preacher cheating on his wife or of an elder who embezzles, is charged with embezzling his employer out of a lot of money. This is Christianity. This is the group that we are members of and that we endorse and that we encourage other people to become a member of. And we have this flung in our face over and over and over again. And all we can do is turn red and gulp and say, well, that's not really what Christianity is all about. Well, how are you going to convince people otherwise? If this is what the historical record shows Christianity to be, how do we respond? Now, before we jump into this, let me give sort of a disclaimer, a word of explanation here. I'm going to use the term Christianity in this lesson in the broadest possible sense. All of those who, in any shape, form, or fashion, claim to be followers of Christ. Now, the reason I do that is because that's the nature of the criticism that is being hurled at us. Whether we like it or not, we call ourselves Christians. We recognize a pretty sharp distinction between what we believe and practice and claim to be and what other people who call themselves Christians claim to be. I recognize that distinction. I'm not denying that. But I'm saying from the standpoint or perspective of the people in the world who look at us, we're all in the same bucket. We claim to be followers of Christ, and trying to tease out the particular distinctions between who we are and what other people call themselves Christians are, that's just lost on a world that knows nothing of those distinctions. And so what I'm trying to do here today is to look at the bigger, broader picture about all of those who would claim to be Christians and how, in any possible way, we could defend what Christianity has become through the years. So the approach we're going to take is we're going to spend a few minutes, first of all, looking at what I would consider to be some inadequate responses to the criticism. These are the kinds of defenses that we're tempted to offer, and they are true defenses. They're not false, but they're inadequate to really answer the nature of the serious charges that are leveled against the faith. And then we're going to look at a couple of things that Christianity does offer that hopefully will lay to rest the concern that people have that all of Christianity is poisoned and tainted and toxic and you need to avoid it. So let's jump in. We'll start with what I call the inadequate responses. Three things that we're going to look at here. You've probably heard all three of these. In fact, you've used them yourself in talking to folks who shun Christianity. But let's walk through them and see how they are inadequate. The first one is that it's been that way from the very beginning, meaning you can go back to the New Testament itself, and you can find plenty of hypocrisy there. You can find people in the New Testament itself who were weak, who failed to live the kind of religion that they claimed to be following. In 1 Corinthians chapter 3, we read of Paul as he's addressing the church at Corinth and the myriad problems that they were dealing with among themselves. He tells them, I could not speak to you as spiritual men, but as carnal men. For where there is envy and strife and divisions among you, are you not carnal? In other words, here's a group of people who are claiming to be followers of Christ, and Paul, to their face, says, you're no different than the people in the world. And the people of the world can see that. They were shaming, they were embarrassing the Savior whose name they wore. In Galatians 5, in verse 15, Paul talks about these people in the churches of Galatia who were biting and devouring one another. And you think the world wasn't noticing that? How many times do people see a group who call themselves Christians just get in a slugfest against each other over some little disagreement, and the world looks at that and says, I don't need that. I can live that kind of life without religion. And so when we point to 1 Corinthians and Galatians, and then in 2 Peter 2, where Peter talks about false teachers who will come in and they will peddle what he calls destructive heresies, because of which the way of truth will be maligned or blasphemed. And so it's true. There have been hypocrites all the way back to the very beginning of the Christian church. It's been that way ever since. But then, why should anyone choose to be part of a religion that from its beginning has been plagued with hypocrites and pretenders? This is true, that it's always been that way, because you're dealing with human beings who are twisted and corrupt and have biases and prejudices and so forth that bubble to the top, and we have that even in Christianity. And so people in the world can say, okay, why should I be part of that group? If you admit openly that even from the beginning you struggled with hypocrites and people faking their religion, then why should I be a part of that? So while this is a true response, it's not really adequate to answer the question. There is a second response that is often given, and that is that Christians are not the only ones with a bad track record. Look again at that passage that Steve read a moment ago in Romans chapter 2. It's in your handout. But you'll notice that Paul, as he is addressing on a theoretical basis, he doesn't have any particular person in mind, but he's talking basically to the Jewish people and their claim to be the people of God. And that was a valid claim. They could historically trace their lineage back to Abraham and Abraham's connection with God and so forth, and all that God had done with their people throughout the centuries. But now Paul's plea to his fellow Jews was, what kind of person are you? What kind of message, what kind of image are you portraying to the Gentile world around you? You preach that a man should not steal. Do you steal? You say that we should not commit adultery. Do you commit adultery? We say you should abhor idols, but do you rob temples in your behavior? In other words, are people seeing hypocrisy in the life that you live? You claim one thing, Paul says, but you're living something else. And people in the world can see it. The Gentiles around you, Paul argues, they can see all of that. And so, look at verse 24, quoting from a passage in the Old Testament, "For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you." Now again, Paul is speaking to a Jewish audience here. And he says, your Judaism is valid, it came from God, but because of the way you are behaving, the Gentiles are blaspheming God. They don't want anything to do with your God because they see the way you are living. So on that point, we could say, okay, people are pointing to the hypocrisy and so forth that Christians are guilty of. Well, the Jews back in the first century were no different. Or sometimes the response is, well, look at Islam today. What is the Muslim faith all about? There was a Muslim scholar shortly after 9/11, as the Western countries were struggling to know how to respond to Islamic terrorism that was spreading around the globe. This Muslim scholar made this statement: not every Muslim is a terrorist, but most every terrorist is a Muslim. And he was saying that with shame. He was acknowledging what the Islamic faith had become. And so, isn't that a legitimate response we could make? Yeah, Christianity has some hypocrites in it, but so does Islam. Or so does atheism. Do a little background research and look at the religious faith of men like Stalin or Mao Zedong in China, or Pol Pot in Cambodia, or Hitler, or go back to the French Revolution and what caused tens of thousands of French to be sent to the guillotine. Atheism. It was people who rejected all religion. Their atheism became a religion. And in that faith, if you will, in that belief system, they felt justified in murdering thousands, millions of people. So we could point to atheism and say, well, we're no worse than them. Now that, of course, suggests that the problem is not unique to Christianity. It's something that's endemic within the human race. We all, as human beings, whatever our background, whatever our belief system, we struggle with all the classic toxic human character traits: envy, pride, selfishness, greed, sloth, hatred of others, or not like ourselves. But we have to pose the question, is this a sufficient response? Does the fact that Christians are not the only ones with a bad track record get us off the hook? And the answer, of course, is no, not really. In fact, all this response does is put Christianity in the same bucket with everyone else. On this comparison, there is no compelling reason to take Christianity seriously because, once again, I can just be an atheist at home and do the same thing. That doesn't elevate Christianity above any other religious or philosophical group. There are hypocrites and pretenders in every human assembly, and all we've done here is just prove that Christians are no different. That doesn't really put us ahead in the race, does it? So that response is inadequate, even though it may be true. And then that brings us to a third inadequate response, and that is, well, look at all the good that Christianity has accomplished historically. Think of the hospitals, the clinics, the soup kitchens, the homeless shelters. Think of the counseling services, the adoption agencies, and on and on and on. All the good things that people who call themselves Christians have been involved in to try to do good and share kindness in this world. And who's going to knock that? Aren't we supposed to show the kindness of God, the kindness of Christ? Yes, all these things are good, but they do not negate all the awful things that have likewise been done in the name of Christ. And besides all that, don't other religious faiths or philosophy systems, don't they likewise perform good works as well? So again, what sets Christianity apart? Why should I be a Christian when there are so many negatives associated with this religion, and in many other respects, Christianity is not really all that much different than anything else? And that brings us then to the next thing that we want to consider, and that is a question, okay, what does Christianity offer that I'm not really going to be able to find anywhere else? What is the thing that I really can get in Christianity that I'm really not going to be able to find in any other philosophical or religious system? Now, I want to suggest for your consideration two things. Number one is that Christianity provides a self-correcting mechanism by which it can critique itself. Now, think this through. Christianity, as a religion, at its heart, is based on a book, not an institution. It's based on a book, not an institution. And that book provides the best antidote to the hypocrisy that afflicts Christianity. Think of the teachings, for example, of Jesus. We talked last week briefly about his Sermon on the Mount that is highly recognized as the greatest treatise on human ethics that's ever been given. But then you go to the other end of the book of Matthew and you have Jesus excoriating the scribes and Pharisees of his day for their hypocrisy in chapter 23. He just flails these guys for the hypocrisy that they were practicing in their supposed relationship with God. We spoke a moment ago of Paul addressing the church at Corinth. Here were people who claimed to be disciples of Christ, and yet in two letters written to these people, Paul had to gently but firmly point out the wrong track these people were on. They were making a mockery of their religion. But the important thing is, it's in the Bible that the Bible writers themselves are pointing God's people to, here's what we ought to be. Here's where you're wrong, and here's where you ought to be. The very book itself that we point to does not just heap all this glowing praise upon ourselves about what great people we are, but instead underscores the fact that we are weak, that we do fail, that we are flawed. When you look at all the early leaders of the New Testament church, these were not sinless saints. These were not people that we could put up on a pedestal and tell our children, oh, you need to be like them. Because in most cases, they had all the same problems and struggles that we have in our own lives. These were flawed men whose weaknesses were put on display and were cataloged in the New Testament. Throughout history, consider the examples of Christianity challenging itself. We spoke earlier of the African slave trade and the role that Christians played in promoting and maintaining that. How did it end? How did the African slave trade finally come to a screeching halt? It was predominantly those who claimed to be Christians in the nation of Great Britain in particular, who rose up in the early 1800s and said, this is not right. This is not biblical. And if we're going to claim in any sense of the word to be followers of Jesus of Nazareth, this has got to stop. And so they lobbied Parliament and their fellow citizens, and they pushed until finally Parliament passed a law outlawing their role in the African slave trade. And historians say that what Great Britain did on that occasion was a type of economic or national econocide. They basically trashed their economy for a couple of generations in order to recover from losing all of this slave labor. But they did it because they knew it was the right thing to do, and it was people pointing back to the Bible and saying, no. How did slavery come to an end in our own country? Now, there was a horrible civil war that was fought over this. But the abolitionists looked at the institution of slavery in our own nation and said, this is not right. And they were basing their criticism of this practice, this institution, on what they could read in the scriptures. It was their Christianity that informed their practice in opposing the slave trade. In more recent years, in our own civil rights movement in the 1960s, it was led by preachers who appealed to the scriptures. One of the most famous Bible verses that was often promoted by these men was the passage in Amos, "Let justice roll down like mighty waters." It was not religion, it was not Christianity that was necessarily responsible for the injustices, but what was needed was more Christianity. Get people to understand what the spirit of the religion of Jesus Christ is all about by going back to the source, critiquing modern practices by the original source, and that's what led people to open up their eyes and say, we've got a problem here and we need to deal with it. Now, we could multiply examples like this on and on, but throughout history, we see great chunks of people who claim to be Christians veering off into apostasy and doing things they should not do, things that are in violation of the faith they claim to follow. But there will always be small groups that grow into large groups that appeal to the scriptures and keep the light shining, that keep pulling people back to, what does God want us to be? Now, are all those who claim to be Christians going to be faithful to that calling? Probably not. Are there going to be mistakes along the way? In some cases, some very serious mistakes. But always there's that lodestar that stands in front of people, pulling them back, and is an influence in drawing people back to what God would have them to be. You do what atheists say that we ought to do. Just eliminate Christianity entirely. And what do you have left? Destroy every Bible on the face of the planet. Then what do we have to fall back on? No, Christianity is not perfect. Yes, those who claim to be Christians have made enormous mistakes throughout history. But there is a source that we can go back to by which we can critique, and we ourselves can criticize our own mistakes in falling away from that perfect standard that God would have us to be. And that brings us then to a second thing that Christianity offers, and that is what I call a theoretical foundation of humility. Now look carefully at every other religion, at every other philosophical system that men have devised and to which they appeal to the majority of the human race. This is how you will find salvation or nirvana or whatever you want to call it. Some kind of state of perfection that all humanity recognizes we're striving toward. We're not there yet, but here's what we want to be. And you look at every other religion, every other philosophical system, and every one of them base their understanding of that salvation, however they define it, as being the result of personal achievement. In other words, it's up to us to be good enough to earn our reward. If we can individually achieve enough deep insights into the nature of reality and human nature and so forth, and if we can develop enough of a righteous behavior, if we can change ourselves to reach a certain level of achievement, then we're locked in. Then we're good. Then we're golden. Then God, whoever he or it is, will grant us the reward, whatever it might be. But do you notice the common element there? It's all about us. What we can know, what we can achieve, what we can become through our own efforts. You get up to this level, and then you're good. I fear a lot of people who call themselves Christians have that same approach to religion. That is not Christianity. Christianity is different from that. At its core, Christianity flips this model on its head. What is the starting point with Christianity? Where does it begin? What's the first fundamental fact that you have to understand before you can take a single step toward becoming a Christian? The fact is, all of us are sinners. All of us, Paul said, sin and fall short of the glory of God. Right? Now, let that soak in. Are any of us going to reach heaven because we've become good enough to please God? Because we've overcome sin in our lives to the point that I've made it. I've arrived. I have achieved salvation on my own. No, the Bible says none of us are going to do that. The Bible expression word is lost. We are all lost, and we desperately need help. We're not capable of saving ourselves. And so the next step in Christianity is that God is the one who does all the heavy lifting here. He sent his Son to this world to live among us, but to live a life of humility and service. And what happened to him? When he came to this earth and he lived as an humble carpenter, just going around doing good to people and teaching them how to be better people, what happened? His generation rejected him. And Larry eloquently described at the Lord's table a moment ago. What became of the Son of God when he came to us? We killed him. Despite the fact that he could have at any moment through that gruesome process said, okay, I've had enough. These people are not worth it. I'm done. He never did that. Do you understand the implications of this? The only perfect man who ever lived gave his life as a ransom for you and me. Because we were not good enough. We couldn't be good enough. Name one other religion. Any other system of philosophical thought that approaches humanity's problems that way. What we're looking at in the story of Jesus Christ is the story of a man who became the perfect model of what humanity ought to be. He lived a life of self-sacrifice, not self-congratulation. Throughout the New Testament, as you read the teachings of Jesus himself and the apostles who followed him, again and again and again, over and over, the message is one of humility, of self-sacrifice, of giving to others, of lowering ourselves that we might exalt others. That's the life he lived. That's the example the apostles set, although sometimes imperfectly, but they always held to that model. This is what God wants people to be. This is what Christianity holds forth for humanity to be. And no other religion, no other system of thought approaches humanity from that standpoint. When those who claim to follow Jesus live a life of pride and selfishness and cruelty, they demonstrate that they have no idea what Christianity is. Oh, they may wear the name, but that's not what Christianity is. That's not who Christians are. And the very book that people claim to be honoring is the source that rebukes their behavior. What does Christianity have to offer that I can't find anywhere else? A self-correcting mechanism. Along the way, if you're going to wear the name of Christ, you're going to have to stare some hard truths in the mirror as you dig into this book. It is going to rebuke. It's going to humble you as you better understand who you are in your relationship to a holy God. But it's also going to provide for you a theoretical foundation of humility that you can build your life on, unlike any other system of thought. It's going to give you a perspective on your role in this world, on your relationship to other people around you, on your relationship to God, to the point that you can cry out to God, "Thank you for what you've done for me." And that will motivate everything. It will change your perspective on life. This is why I'm a Christian. This is why I plead with you to be a Christian. Not because you'll now have an opportunity to boast and to brag and to strut about trying to show other people how great you are, how good you are, what you've achieved. No, it's just the opposite. Because all of us, we have opened, we have buried our souls before God and before the world. We are imperfect. We are failures. We need help. And in Jesus Christ, the Son of God, we have found that help. Do you want that this morning in your life? Become a Christian. Become a disciple of Christ. And you're going to find all the help you need to get you through this life. If you need to respond to the Lord's invitation, we encourage you to come now as we stand and sing.
I come with a humble heart.